If you're wondering where your next meal is coming from, try Caviar. Caviar delivers the best restaurants. You can order on the Caviar app or online. Go to caviar.com or find their app in the App Store or on Google. Get the food you crave delivered to your house. There's pizza, Chinese, much more, Indian, sushi, barbecue, all coming to you from local restaurants, restaurants you may already know, restaurants you may already like. Order today and pay no delivery fee at all on your first order. Plus, take $10 off your first order of $30 or more with code WORLDLY. This offer is valid until March 15th, 2018. Again, you can get $10 off your first order of $30 or more with code WORLDLY, caviar.com, or the Caviar app. Welcome to WORLDLY, Vox's weekly guide to the most important stories in the world. Part of the Vox Media Podcast Network, it's Yochi here with Zach.
Hey.
And for the first time, Alexia Underwood, who's an editor on our team and also speaks Arabic, which is cool.
That is true. Hi.
So this week, we're going to be talking about the Syrian civil war. I want to stress the Syrian civil war, a civil war taking place in Syria, where the following things happened. Here's the first. That's the sound of the pilot of an Israeli Apache helicopter getting permission to shoot down an Iranian drone that had flown into Israeli airspace from Syria. The second thing that happened was the U.S. killing an enormous number, we don't know how many, of Russian mercenaries attacking a base inside Syria. It's Russian mercenaries in Syria because, of course, there are Russian mercenaries in Syria. So I want to talk about that. We're going to talk about how a war that began with Syrians fighting Syrians now has this many countries, this many militias all fighting at the same time in the same place. So, Zach, let's start there. Let's talk about where this war began and how we got here and who all is fighting.
Right. So the war started in 2011, essentially, after the Arab Spring protests began in Syria. And those were peaceful, pro-democracy protests that the government responded to with force. Bashar al-Assad's regime started gunning down people in the streets. And that led the protesters and some defectors from the Syrian military to form militias to fight against the government, turning what was a protest movement into a civil war. Then a bunch of other countries decided they had an interest in the outcome of this fighting. At various different points, the Russians, who have a military base in Syria, decided that they wanted to help Assad survive. The Iranians, who see Assad as a key ally, helped support him, sending troops and weapons. The Gulf Arab states, who see Iran as their fundamental enemy, backed various different factions of Syrian rebels. Islamists saw the chaos as an opportunity, that is to say Al-Qaeda and eventually ISIS, and moved in their people. The United States wanted Assad to go and did some things to try to topple him, but mostly was concerned about ISIS, and so got itself involved in the counter-ISIS war. And Turkey is worried about the Kurds in the north of Syria, who are essentially separate from most of the other axes of conflict, except they've been fighting ISIS a lot and want their own independent territory. But Turkey sees that as being dangerous on their borders because they have a large Kurdish population. So they've been fighting the Kurds in northern Syria, and the Kurds are helping the United States fight ISIS. This is all so complicated, and there's so much different stuff happening at the same time, but it all stems at root from the idea that multiple different countries and factions feel a strong stake in the outcome of the civil war that's driving all of this.
I think that's a really good sum up. I want to go back for 1 second to what just happened this past week when the U.S. apparently killed an unknown number of Russian mercenaries who are in the region. I think what's kind of interesting is that even though we know that there are all these different players and actors, there's this game of plausible deniability that's going on. So, for example, the Russian government denied that they had any people fighting in that area. The U.S. said that they refused so far to speculate on the makeup of the pro-regime forces that they had attacked. And again, we have to think that so the U.S. were working with the Kurds and they were at this military base in Deir ez-Zor. Pro-Assad forces attacked them. Apparently, they were Russians involved, but
nobody thinks they were like uniformed Russian government, right? Like
right.
These are
Russian mercenaries.
Yeah, who the Russian government uses to maintain the plausible deniability that you were talking about earlier.
Exactly, exactly. And then to go back further to the other events that have been escalating the tensions in the region this week, the drone that Yochi mentioned earlier, Iran said that it wasn't their drone that wandered into Israel. They said that reports of that were ridiculous. They also said that they don't have troops on the ground and they're only providing military advice to Syria.
LOL, okay.
Sure. So I understand the concept of plausible deniability because it it avoids getting these regional powers involved in direct conflict. But how long are people going to actually deny that they're involved? And does this do more harm than good? Because if no one accepts responsibility or says they're involved, no one can really be held accountable.
So I just want to take a step back because there are so many people fighting. It's a hard thing to keep track of, right? So we went from Syria against Syria, right? So two groups in one country. Now there are at least six countries and at least three militias that are all fighting, right? So you've gone from a relatively easy to understand civil war. We know a civil war. We had one in the U.S. Like, it's usually two sides in the same country. Now you've got six other countries, three other groups. And those numbers matter because they get to the bottom of the confusion. And then there's the other confusion, which is, what are they fighting for, right? So broadly speaking, it's either to get rid of Assad or to defeat ISIS. And you've seen the U.S. itself, you know, Zach, you referenced this a moment ago. The U.S. itself has been confused because under Obama, the policy was Assad had to go. Trump took office and kind of winked nod and said, well, Assad's kind of okay. You know, he's fighting terrorists. We don't really have a problem with it. Then Assad used chemical weapons. So Trump struck a Syrian weapons base. Now you have Rex Tillerson, Mr. Charisma, still in his job, sidemen, saying the U.S. will be in Syria indefinitely. And so we've gotten stuck in a quagmire, theoretically. Part of it is just the confusion. And the U.S. is a good way to look at that confusion. We could talk about other countries and we'll talk about other countries, but we don't know what Donald Trump wants to do in Syria.
Right. And while some of this is a Trump problem, that is to say Trump doesn't understand the intricacies of the Syrian civil war, to put it lightly, it also is an Obama problem, right? There's just a difficult issue here, which is, do you fight against the awful, brutal regime that is murdering its own people? And the Assad regime is horrific in the way that it's conducted this war and was before, honestly. But at the same time, fighting that regime would require risking confrontation with Russia and Iran, that's to say a nuclear-armed power and another country that has had an active nuclear program. It's mind-bogglingly dangerous to try to get more deeply involved in the Syrian civil war. And so the Obama people didn't want to seem soft on the Assad regime and indeed wanted it to go, but also didn't want to risk a full-on conflict with any of Assad's patrons. So the end result is this kind of muddling, middling policy where they say Assad has to go but won't really do anything to try to back it up. And under Trump, that confusion is continued and magnified.
You know, Alexei, maybe you could walk us through a little bit the Israel part of it, because I think it might be easier in some ways for people to understand Russia went in to help Assad, Iran went in to help Assad. But how did Israel get yanked into this to the point that they had one of their planes shot down inside of Syria for the first time in decades, followed by this wave of airstrikes? But kind of how did they get involved and why? Because I think in some ways they're the most confusing to understand.
So last week, the way that Israel got involved was that an Iranian drone that was operating in Syria purposefully flew into Israeli territory. The Israelis shot down the drone. And then they responded by striking areas in Syria where they knew that Iran was operating and also Syrian regime forces. In the process of this, Syrian regime forces shot down an Israeli F-16. That's the short answer as to how Israel got involved most immediately. The question that a lot of us are asking is this going to lead to direct one-on-one conflict, or, you know, kind of all-out war between Iran and Israel, who have until this point been fighting via proxy?
So I think people were really worried about that, or more worried about that this weekend when it first happened. Or at least I was in the Middle East then, actually, for reasons we'll talk about later on in the show. And it seemed like people were a little concerned. But at the same time, Israel has been striking targets in Syria for almost the entire civil war. That's because Hezbollah is a terrorist group on the Lebanese border that they see as a very serious threat to their own security, rightly so. They've fought wars with Hezbollah before, and Syria is a route through which Iran arms its proxy, Hezbollah. So the Israelis have been bombing arms shipments and various different things that are designed to go to Hezbollah for a while. This is an escalation of that continuing pattern, but the point is that none of those escalated into war in the past. And so far, it doesn't look like anyone really wants this particular thing to get worse.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think to borrow the name of a sister podcast and get into the weeds for a second, it's important to understand the why Israel's doing what it's doing. And Zach, I think you hit that well, but also in slightly more detail, kind of the what happened. I mean, Israel's been concerned for a long time that you've got Hezbollah not only now on the borders inside of Lebanon, but also now in Syria, because Syria, the border between the two countries, has been tense for many decades. And so the fear is you've now got Hezbollah capable of firing drones into Israel, firing rockets into Israel from Syria as well as from Lebanon. And so for Israel, they've got the concern about Iran, which is kind of the big existential concern. They've got the more immediate concern about what is Hezbollah going to do to them. And so Israel is willing to take risks it hasn't taken before. For Israel to fly F-16s into Syria, One, it's a violation of Syrian sovereignty, but two, Syria has very advanced missile defense systems, and they have very advanced systems to shoot down planes. And so when this Israeli plane was shot down, it was the first time a plane has been lost in Syria, I believe, since 1972. You're seeing kind of a milestone in this, because you have Israel doing something it had not been willing to do before. And Zach, to a point you made a second ago, Israel hit Syrian bases, Israel hit Iranian bases, and one of the bases it hit had Russian troops on it. It didn't hit any Russians, it didn't kill any Russians, but if we're trying to spin out all the horrible ways that this could evolve, and this is kind of the point I think we want to hit, if Israel had killed Russians, it's terrible. We're now in a whole different phase of this conflict. If Israel had killed a lot of Iranians, it's terrible. And that, I think, is kind of the big point here. It isn't just that this war is complicated and has evolved, although it is and it has. It's that that means two things. One, this war is going to go longer and be bloodier than it might otherwise have been. And two, and you know, Zach, you talked to this when we were talking about all of this yesterday, the possibility of other wars outside of the borders of Syria, of other countries fighting each other, you have that now as a real risk too.
Right. If you think of the Syrian civil war as not anymore a war just between or over the survival of the Assad regime, but a series of different conflicts inside of one overarching frame, which is the Assad rebel struggle, and each of those have different objectives, different ultimate goals, and different pathways towards escalation, then it starts to become a lot more frightening because these involve some really serious, really large countries. And those countries are put, by virtue of their various different involvements in the civil war, in situations where they can be in conflict in specific ways, like the one you were just outlining. There are other ones. For instance, if Turkish forces were to bomb Americans who are aiding Kurds, right, as part of their anti-Kurdish campaign, then you have a conflict between two NATO allies. You don't have them necessarily going to war. You probably don't, but you have serious, serious tensions.
You know, a few minutes ago, Yochi, you talked a little bit about the future and whether or not this would escalate into, you know, a larger regional war. I spoke with Dan Shapiro, who's the former U.S. ambassador to Israel under Obama. He's currently in Tel Aviv at the Institute for National Security Studies, a couple weeks ago, about his take on what's going on in the region. And then after the Israeli F-16 went down last week, I reached out the other day and I asked him if he thought that this meant that things had the potential to escalate into a full-on direct conflict between Israel and Iran. He said he didn't think so. Like we had talked about earlier, both sides probably want to avoid further escalation. But he did say that if Iran took things one step further, then that could be a game changer. For example, if they established a precision-guided missile production facility in Lebanon on the border with Israel, you know, very close to the border with Israel, Israel could see this as an unacceptable threat and strike directly, which would then pull in Hezbollah, Iran's proxy in the region. So then Israel could be pulled into a conflict in Lebanon while it's also fighting in Syria. So it would be basically fighting a war on two fronts. And that's one way that things could escalate. But he said that he doesn't think that that's inevitable. It's unclear in that situation what Russia or the U.S. would do, if anything, to try to avoid things spiraling out of control. But I think it's definitely a concern.
And so we talk a lot about proxy. I mean, it's a war that it's a phrase you hear about. The U.S. haven't done this during the Cold War, now happening here. And literally what we're talking about is one country providing weapons and arms to another group, that group, at least in theory, doing the bidding of the country that gave them that weapons. Hezbollah is interesting because this is a group, you know, Alexia, you were talking about this before, based in Lebanon, that has sent a huge number of people into Syria and has lost a huge number of people. By some estimates, it's between 1,000, possibly 2,000 fighters who have died inside of Syria. And so Hezbollah is a very powerful group. We've talked about them on the show before, and we'll doubtlessly talk about them again. But a proxy war doesn't come without costs, right? It isn't something where it just happens and the groups kind of go back to the way they were. Hezbollah has now had more experience fighting other countries besides Israel. So you could argue in some weird ways it's been a benefit for them, but they've lost a lot of people. Russia has lost a lot of people. Iran has lost a lot of people. And so the death toll, and Zach, we were talking about these numbers yesterday because they're so staggering. The death toll for Syria, which is really, you know, the horror of it on a human level is extraordinary. And then there's the impact of it on a military level for all the groups that are fighting.
I was listening to BBC Arabic this morning just to kind of hear how Arabic language press was treating what was happening and the heightening, you know, the tensions in the region. And actually, they're reporting on the fact that Tillerson spoke today and said that we need to recognize Hezbollah's role in world politics, which seemed, you know, was kind of interesting because it sounds like he's almost granting legitimacy to this group that the U.S. has thus far considered a terrorist group.
Yeah, I mean, my sense of that is that this is part of the U.S. trying to show how the threat from Iran and Iranian-backed proxies is getting worse and larger over the course of these various different conflicts in the Middle East. And it's so easy to get bogged down in the geopolitics of Syria and to talk about hypotheticals and maybes, but so many people have died, right? The UN stopped officially counting. They couldn't do it anymore because it was too dangerous. The last count from a UN official that I've seen was from about 2 years ago, and it's 400,000 people died. That's not even an official count. It's just his estimate based on what he's read. That's more, significantly more, than all the people who died in the entire Iraq war after the US invasion, which was a devastating, devastating war. The idea that these countries are playing out their own hypothetical interests and playing almost a kind of game with Syrian lives is really disturbing if you think about it on a truly personal level.
Right. I mean, it's also, of course, triggered one of the worst refugee crises in history, which has then destabilized Europe. I mean, so it's got all these kind of ancillary add-ons. Zach, the only thing that I would take issue with slightly is that it's kind of a game for these other countries. I know you didn't mean that in a literal sense, but for a lot of these countries, they see this as existential. I mean, for Israel, they don't see pinging Iran as sort of a little thing. They see an Iranian group on their border as an existential threat. For Turkey, they've been fighting Kurds for decades. So they don't see an empowered Kurdish army that's on their border as something small. They see this as an existential threat to them. And I want to make that point simply because the lives here are extraordinarily high, the death toll, but they're not mutually exclusive, right? It's not that countries are sort of fiddling and then people are dying. It's that these countries see this as existential, whether we agree or don't agree. And because they see it as existential, they're willing to cause this mass suffering on an almost unimaginable scale.
Or at least contribute to it. It's just the way that it's often talked about as a kind of struggle for influence. And certainly in the press, it neutralizes the human toll of what's going on. And sometimes the way that policymakers can talk about things, and you've seen this in American policymakers too, it's this very cold lens that doesn't think about the consequences. It's like a marginal gain of influence for the United States is worth X number of human lives.
Lateral damage, people refer to it as. It's ridiculous.
No one ever spells that out. But it is worth also saying, to your point, that these hypothetical situations of things spinning out of control in Syria also would mean many, many, many people dying. Right? Like this is a situation where, you know, maybe 500,000 people have died and maybe many more will continue to die as a result of these overlapping sets of interests and sense of existential peril as a result of the conflict. That's part of why it's worth highlighting all of the different factions, right? Not just to play geopolitical risk as analysts, it's to understand that we're still in serious peril, and we being the world, from the ongoing Syrian civil war.
So I think I would just wrap with this because when we're talking about the Syrian civil war, we need to just remember in this past week where you've had, again, an Israeli plane flying over be shot down. You've had a helicopter flown by Turkey that was shot down. You've had Russian planes potentially being hit. You've had Russian mercenaries being killed. So you've had this really vivid reminder of how many other groups are fighting and dying inside of Syria. But I want to just end with this. You're facing the real risk now of other people dying outside of Syria. Because if a war starts between Israel and Hezbollah, Israel and Iran, Turkey and the Kurds, there's no reason at all to think by some miracle, that stays inside the borders of Syria. More likely, it goes outside the borders of Syria. You have Israelis dying inside of Israel, Iranians dying perhaps inside of Iran, Lebanese dying because they're always caught in the middle, Turks dying, Kurds dying. And so it's just worth remembering that the Syrian civil war is baffling in some ways. It is evolving constantly. But the risk right now isn't simply the extraordinarily high human toll in Syria getting worse. It's the human toll outside of Syria beginning to rise itself. Hey, worldly listeners, it's Yochai, and I'd like to tell you about a new podcast that those of us at Vox are really excited about called Today Explained. It'll help you answer all the questions that you might ask about the day's news, like what happens if we get into war with North Korea? Or why doesn't Puerto Rico have power yet? Sean Ramos-Firm will host, and I'll be on occasionally, as well as many of your other favorite Vox podcast voices. We launch this Monday, February 19th, and we'll have a new episode every weekday afternoon. That's Today Explained, coming February 19th and publishing every weekday afternoon. Subscribe on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. So for elsewhere, we're going to a very different part of the Middle East, more specifically an extraordinarily luxurious resort in the Middle East where our friend Zach managed to spend some time, send some photos, making us all jealous. And we often talk about a theme on the show that sounds amorphous, which is the way that Trump's policies are making America seem less relevant, reducing American influence, that can be something that just sounds like poli-sci talk and international relations talk. But Zach, in between being at the pool of this fancy resort, you saw this kind of play out in practice. And why were you there and what did you see?
Okay, so this was in Dubai. And the United Arab Emirates' government had thrown this big swanky conference called the World Government Summit at this big swanky resort. To give you an idea, there's like 2 kilometers of private beaches. The entire hotel thing has 5 different areas, all of which look like giant castles, basically. You can take a boat ride on a canal in the middle of it to an exclusive 5-star Thai restaurant. It's like a super weird sort of thing, right? And this conference is supposed to be a big showcase for this, well, a little more authoritarian than they want you to think monarchy. And they even paid for journalists like me to go come and stay and enjoy the conference. So you've got really famous people and really important people all talking about the state of the world and the future of world politics. You've got the head of the World Bank. You had the Prime Minister of India giving the keynote address. You had Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about colonizing Mars. I interviewed him for a little bit. You had Arianna Huffington for some reason. And like a bunch of other people like that. My favorite was a British guy who is the world's self-described first cyborg who put an antenna in his head so he could see color and also ultraviolet some other stuff. It was an odd place. But what was interesting about it, what was really fascinating about all of this weirdness put together was that nobody seemed to want to talk about the United States. There wasn't, and a thing about the future of world governance, America was either sidelined or frankly often insulted and seen as a barrier towards effective, smart, forward-looking policymaking.
Let's hear for a second kind of what that sounds like in practice.
If the U.S. cannot even get a modicum of good governance, how on earth do you expect developing nations to follow on?
Well, why do you suggest that if the U.S. does it in a certain way, everybody else has to do it in a certain way, you know?
So I picture this as some like guy pounding a table, kind of spittle flying out of his mouth, hitting the table in front of him. But who was that and why was he so angry?
So the first one was the moderator, a CNN journalist named Richard Quest. The second one was the head of the OECD, Angel Gurria. And the OECD is an organization of advanced developed democracies for the most part. It's a big deal that the head of that organization, who said a number of other critical things about the current state of American politics, is openly derisive of the United States as a model for the rest of the world. And he wasn't the only person at the conference to say that. You know, I talked to a lot of people about climate change, and they all said, like, basically, well, this is a verbatim quote, the U.S. isn't the only country in the world. It's people see the U.S. as either a dysfunctional kind of democracy or a barrier to the world trying to get together and solve big problems.
And I think the Paris Accords is a good example of that. And that came up in the interview that you did, correct?
Well, I think that's part of why, right? Trump said this was, you know, America was being cheated by the Paris Agreement. The rest of the world saw the U.S. as finally getting on board with something that they thought was really important and helping orchestrate a measure of international cooperation. Like, I interviewed the prime minister of a country
Antigua
that might literally
Barbada.
Sink. Yeah. And that was devastated by one of the hurricanes, and they've since become really, really concerned about climate change.
And I think you're sort of seeing 2 dynamics play out. One, and we're hearing this publicly from German leaders in a way they've never said it before, saying that they can't rely on the U.S. the way they once did. So on one hand, you have the U.S. being mocked and derided. But on the other hand, and I think this is the more substantive and important, the U.S. is just becoming irrelevant. Countries are making deals without the U.S. They're sort of making agreements without the U.S. You saw this with the TPP, this massive trade deal. Trump took office, said he would pull the U.S. out. It's a promise he kept, one of the few he did. So what happened? Flash ahead. Basically, the same deal happened just with China instead of the U.S. So it isn't simply the U.S. being mocked and derided. I mean, Zach, you heard some of that up close. But some of the interesting policy discussions that are happening, people genuinely trying to solve crises like climate change, that's still all happening. It's just we're not part of it.
Right. And trade in general is a good example of this, right? Because trade's a fundamentally international issue that needs to be resolved through things like the World Trade Organization and other systems that regulate how countries interact with each other. So rules have to be made to a degree. And if the U.S. is just withdrawing or trying to undermine the agreements it's already a part of, other countries are going to be going about trying to set the rules of the road for how free trade agreements and trade more generally should operate. And I heard a bunch of high-level international trade officials talking about how other countries like France and Canada and even Rwanda were taking the lead on trade when the United States was pulling back at this conference, right? It's are really striking, especially since in 2016, the U.S. was the guest of honor country at this very conference, and Obama gave a speech.
Did you get the impression that people felt that the U.S. was leaving this void behind, or were they just kind of like moving on and going about their everyday business?
So I think it's two things. I think one, it really is that there was a unipolar world, and now we've moved to a multipolar world, right? Or at least are moving towards one in which many different other countries now play the leadership role that the United States used to play almost unilaterally. And the second part is that it's Trump specifically, right? Like, U.S. relative power has declined for lots of reasons, and relative influence has declined for lots of reasons, and that they happened before Trump. But the second is that these specific decisions, this kind of America first approach to foreign policy, is really isolating the United States from other countries and accelerating the process of weakening American influence.
And I think that to me is a more interesting piece than kind of Trump qua Trump. It's the ideas that are percolating up, and they're interesting, and we'll talk about them in a second. But it isn't like progress stops. I think sometimes in the U.S. we look at it and think, well, Donald Trump's pulled us out of this deal, or he's done this thing that's hard to believe, and therefore the world has just stopped and gone off the rails. And it hasn't. The world kind of chugged along. Other countries step in. Problems may get solved in a good way. Just the U.S. doesn't benefit from it. But two things that have struck me about listening, Zach, when you came back. One is the ideas about climate change, about gender equality, about trade, about all these things that we care about and should care about where we're just not part of the conversation. There's one I know you want to talk about. The other is the U.S. was always the place that smart people the world over wanted to come to, right? If you were a smart Chinese person or a Japanese person or an Asian person elsewhere or from the Arab world, if you could come to the U.S., you would, because these are the best universities, and that's changing. There's a stat that I saw that I think drove it home. The number of new foreign students has declined by 7% this past fall. That doesn't sound like much, but it is. Part of it is that they tend to spend more money because they don't get financial aid. But part of it is when those people go home, they're taking American influence, American culture, to a degree American values, and we are getting from them their ideas, their patents, their thoughts about how to solve problems. And so if we're losing on the world stage, we're also losing for ourselves, right? Like, it's a problem not just for the world that the U.S. is irrelevant. It's a problem for us.
I think at least some of that can be attributed as well to Trump's policies like the travel ban. I mean, I know, speaking to people personally, people are afraid to come to the U.S. They're afraid that, you know, especially Muslim students are afraid that they're going to be stigmatized, they're going to be targeted. It's a problem.
Well, that's one thing that really, the travel ban point, I think, is especially important. It really hits home when you're at a major international conference, because here, you know, you can walk around and you hear people speaking half a dozen different languages with even more different accents in those languages. And it's just casually multicultural. Like, this is a place in which you just accept that people are from all sorts of different kinds of backgrounds, and you have to overcome that, or even that it's an asset, right, in trying to figure out how to deal with the world's problems. This administration has adopted a very different vision of multiculturalism and of the place of foreigners in American life. And that's intrinsically isolating in a world that is and has to be multicultural. The kind of nationalism, an almost overt white nationalism that you hear from the White House in a lot of cases, really is self-marginalizing.
And it's terrifying just for a lot of people. Yeah.
But so, like, I mean, I want to go back to this conference. So you're there, you're walking the hallways, and you're going to panels, you're hearing all these this interesting people, plus Huffington, plus Robert De Niro, who are certainly not necessarily in that category.
Plus the cyborg.
Oh, always the cyborg.
But when you're hearing them talk, like, what are the ideas you're hearing from them that we're not talking about here, but maybe we should?
So one of the cool ones that I heard, that there were two different panels on actually, was something called gender budgeting. So the idea here is that any estimate of the costs of policies that a country is thinking of, specifically economic policies, needs to take into account disparate gender impact. So for example, if a specific tax increase would affect two earner homes more than it would affect a one earner home, that would decrease the incentive for women to enter the workforce, given that it's usually women who are staying at home otherwise, right? And in essence, create an economic atmosphere where it's much more likely that men will succeed in business than women. And traditionally, economic analysis hasn't really taken gender into account in that fashion. So a number of countries have started doing this and adopting this, and it's become a major priority of the IMF in particular to push this out in different places. France, for example, has a very advanced gender budgeting program. Can you imagine right now that kind of proposal coming from this White House or this Congress, right? These are the things that help establish leaders, international leaders, in issues that are of global concern, like women's equality. And the United States, by virtue of having both a political system that's gridlocked and an administration that's not interested in these kinds of issues of global concern, it feels irrelevant to these conversations about innovative and exciting new policies like gender budgeting.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to imagine that happening under this administration.
You're also, I think, seeing technology that the U.S. is falling behind on suddenly become more and more important to these countries. So China has some of the best facial recognition programs on the planet, which is in part because they're surveillance state, but in part because these things have value. Their value is in fighting terrorism or crime, and the U.S. really has fallen behind. Artificial intelligence, the U.S. is still ahead because that's one place where there's a lot of money coming. But these other countries are thinking about it not just as a way to make money, but how to use that in governance. Like, how do you take the power of machines learning to make governance better, to better understand laws, to better understand the way that regulations might work? And Zach, I wonder how much you picked up on that, the sort of nexus between technology and policy as another area where countries are doing it and we're not.
Well, that was like the biggest theme at the conference, right? It's really oriented around the future in big, big terms, which meant technological advances in the way that they would change policy. AI was one of the biggest ones. There was a museum of the future there you could walk through, which showed you different ways that AI could be used.
And picturing like an Arab world Epcot Center.
Yeah, basically, it was strange. Like you could go and push buttons that tell you how AI could be biased or not work well. And then there was a giant AI screen that moved around and talked to you about how AI would change the future. A lot of this is overblown, honestly.
It's a little terrifying too, personally.
People predicted all sorts of crazy things at this conference, but they all come from a place of fundamental truth, which is that when you have machines developing this ability to learn about the world and pick up on patterns and identify things using high levels of computing power that the human brain simply doesn't have, you do gain an advantage in the assessment of policy and in trying to understand the world around you. And that will change politics in some ways. Some ideas include integrating machine assessments of various different predictable policy outcomes or the political risk that they create based on public opinion data. Those were ideas that I literally heard advanced. And if you don't have those in the future, your country will be limited to a degree, or if you're falling behind on them and its ability to make innovative, smart, and effective policies.
I agree that bringing AI into the policymaking sphere is sort of the next level. It's the next level and the next step in the conversation. It does bring up a lot of ethical issues, though. Did that come up at the conference at all?
Yeah, there was a whole exhibit about the ethical issues that were raised in this Museum of the Future. And so one of them was that you could push on a screen and it would show you how different AI technologies would work given how you could program them. So one of them, an example is the same technology could power a delivery drone for shipping as an armed military autonomous machine that could kill on its own or choose who to decide. And you would use the same fundamental technology. It's just a question of what you tell it to do and what patterns you tell it to pick up on and what equipment you give it. And so, yeah, there are tremendous ethical issues that are created by advancing in computing power. This killer robots debate in particular is a whole thing that we can't get into, but it's a big deal and another kind of emerging international policy debate.
So, I mean, in between you sending us these jealousy-inducing photos of the fancy pools at the hotel you were at, I came away thinking the good news is there are smart people who are thinking very seriously about major problems. The bad news is America increasingly isn't among them. We'll end there on that cheerful note. Zach, we're glad that you are back safely from the dangerous place of a resort in Dubai.
Oh, yeah, it was horrible. I'll try to post some of the pictures in our Worldly show notes.
Alexia, thank you for being on. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
We want to say thank you, as always, to Peter Leonard, who this week did double duty as both our producer and our engineer, to Julie Bogan, our social media manager. If you like what you heard, we hope you do. Come find us, subscribe, rate, review. Find us on Twitter or reach us on Twitter at #worldlypodcast. You can email us worldly@vox.com. We respond to almost everything we can. We read everything we get. We will be with you all next week.